Good afternoon. This meeting of the House Health and Services Committee will now come to order. It is 3:06 on Thursday, March 30th, Capitol Room 106. Members present are Representative Eastman, Sullivan Leonard, Edgman, Tarr, Johnson, and myself, Representative Sponholz. Let the record reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Take a moment to silence your cell phones all the way off vibrate if you can. We've just been joined by Representative Keto as well, so we've got a full complement today. Before we get started, I want to thank Butch Carber, the House HES Secretary from Records, and Alex B.B. Goudichet from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee. Today, our committee aide is Bernice Nisbet, who is pinch hitting for Ted Madsen. So if we have any technical difficulties, please be generous with us. Today, we're going to be hearing four bills. First up, we're going to hear House Bill 164 by the governor relating to the long-term care ombudsman. Second, we're going to be hearing House Bill 100 by Representative Chris Tuck, designating Post-Traumatic Stress Injury Awareness Day. Third, we'll be hearing HB 186 by Representative Tallarico, covering the laws related to food donations. Fourth, we'll hear public testimony on the governor's HB 159 dealing with the opioid crisis. And we'll be taking some amendments on that, I believe, today. So we are going to start with House Bill 164, which deals with the laws governing the long-term care ombudsman. Teresa Holt, Alaska's long-term care ombudsman, would you please come forward, put yourself on the record, and walk us through the bill? Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Teresa Holt. I'm the state long-term care ombudsman. Thank you for hearing House Bill 164. If it pleases the Chair, I'd like to start with a brief overview.
Please do. Thank you.
Okay. House Bill 164 will amend provisions of Alaska Statute 4762, Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman, and Alaska Statute 47.24, Protection of Vulnerable Adults, to ensure alignment with the Older Americans Act and its implementing regulations. In 2016, the Older Americans Act was reauthorized and new regulations for long-term care ombudsmen were created. As a result, the Administration for Community Living reviewed all states to ensure compliance with these changes. Through this review, two Alaska statutes were identified as being out of alignment with the Older Americans Act and the long-term care ombudsman regulations. But regardless, we feel that these are good changes and will be helpful to our office. Briefly, this bill would align state statutes and federal statutes and regulations to ensure the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman only shares resident information with informed consent. To ensure the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman can obtain records to investigate and make referrals when a resident is unable to provide informed consent. Adds new terms for resident and resident representative. Due to a conflict of interest, removes the option for mandatory reporters to meet reporting requirements by submitting reports to the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman. To clarify the separation of the role of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman from the role of the Division of Health and Social Services, and to clarify that the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman may serve residents in long-term care facilities under the age of 60. Would you like me to walk through the sectional analysis?
I would love you to do that. Thank you.
So hopefully you all have a copy. Mm-hmm. Section 1 and 2 are technical amendments that update the name of the entity responsible for receiving reports for vulnerable adults. Section 3 removes the requirement for DHSS to forward all reports for individuals over the age of 60 to the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman for investigation, while adding passive language to allow DHSS to forward these reports as necessary. Section 4 clarifies that DHSS is responsible to investigate all reports for vulnerable adults. Section 5 removes the obligation for the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman to share its reports with DHSS agencies without consent. Section 6 removes DHSS requirement to do a face-to-face interview for each report on a vulnerable adult. Sections 7 and 8 align state language with the Older Americans Act, providing authority for the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman to respond to complaints of adults under the age of 60 living in long-term care facilities. Section 9, Part A, ensures the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman has access to all residents of long-term care facilities. Part B allows the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman to obtain records with consent of the resident, their representative, by subpoena or court order. Section 10 allows the State Long-Term Care Ombudsman, in certain circumstances, to share resident information with other agencies when a resident is unable to provide consent and has no representative to provide consent. Section 11 is amended to include residents of all ages who live in long-term care facilities. Section 12 defines, or changes the definition for older Alaskan and adds the definition for resident and resident representative. Section 13 repeals Alaska Statute 47.24.010F. to eliminate the requirement for the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman to receive mandatory reports of harm. Alaska Statute 47.24.013C3, to eliminate the requirement for the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman to share our reports with other agencies without consent. And Alaska Statute 47.24.013E, to eliminate the requirement for the Office of the Long-Term Care Ombudsman to substantiate reports of harm on behalf of the Department of Health and Social Services. I'm available for questions.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Holt. Is there any questions for Ms. Holt?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Representative Sullivan.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a real question. I highlighted Section 3 and the analysis here, and I just wanted to see the rationale for the amendment in that, if you wouldn't mind.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Sullivan. Quite often we go to facilities and there might be somebody in a long-term care facility, which is a nursing home or assisted living home, mm-hmm. who's maybe 55.
Okay.
Well, under the old way of doing things, we could only work with folks who are over 60. So this allows us to serve anybody who's in a long-term care facility under the age of 60.
Okay, through the chair.
Proceed.
So as I'm reading with the amendment here, it says to remove the requirement to forward reports of maltreatment to the long-term care ombudsman office. Is that what you were just referring to?
Oh, I'm sorry.
And that was Section 4. I think you were just talking about Ms. Holt, and I think we're talking about Section 3, unless our documents are off.
Right, Section 3. I'm just curious.
Section 3 removes the requirement to forward reports of maltreatment to the long-term care ombudsman's office.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Sullivan. If you read the original statute, mm-hmm. It says that Department of Health and Social Services will forward all reports over the age of 60 to our office for investigation.
Mm-hmm.
The ombudsman has different investigation priorities. Mm-hmm. We investigate issues for residents of long-term care facilities and resolve those to their satisfaction.
Mm-hmm.
Adult Protective Services and licensing do it to substantiate a report of harm, to verify whether the facts were done or not. Mm-hmm. And so this really just clarifies that DHSS will be doing those verifications. They can forward those reports to us, and we can go and, you know, our statute requires that we talk with the resident or the resident's representative and ask if they want us to assist them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the difference.
Madam Chair, just to follow up.
Proceed.
Okay. I'm just questioning that because, I mean, wouldn't you want to know that information?
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
It seems like it's something they're providing you with, which may or may not be a tool for you to use, but if you had it in a file that at least had it recorded, it may assist you in your process of helping those that are asking for your assistance,
mm-hmm.
if that makes sense.
Do you have a response, Ms. Holt?
Yes. So earlier, about 2 years ago, we worked gathered together all the players who deal with adults who live, or seniors who live in long-term care facilities. Mm-hmm. And so we've sort of worked out a system of who is going to be the first person to investigate certain situations. And so in that memorandum of agreement, it says that if Adult Protective Services, residential licensing, or quality assurance feels like it's a report that we should have a copy of, that they will forward that to us. Many of the reports that come in as reports of harm are about a resident who got up, didn't call for help, fell to the floor. They checked them out and they were fine. That's probably the majority of those reports. And so it takes a lot of our time if we have to go through every single one of those. And so we don't need to see those kinds of reports because other central intake is looking at all of those.
I'll take your answer for now. I appreciate
okay.
that very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Is there a question, Representative Eastman?
Thank you. Through the chair. So if there's an incident of maltreatment of someone in long-term care, does your office want to know about that?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we do. And we get probably, I want to say, between 15 and 20 reports every day. And I think through our agreement, those type of reports will not change. Central Intake probably gets 50 reports every day. And many of those are at a level that the situation is already taken care of. And so we don't need those reports. Mm-hmm. And folks can also call our office, and we get a lot of calls that way also. So I guess I don't really, I think that this will work. Mm-hmm. And we're okay with it. That's why we put in the passive language that they can forward those reports to us.
Thank you.
On this point, I think I understand where my colleagues are going. If I understand clearly, there are reports of harm which are unsubstantiated, which you believe don't need forwarded because they were resolved or the steps that needed to be taken to ensure that the patient was, or that the elder in care is actually safe and everything is fine have already been taken, and that you want to narrow the requirement for data reporting or for reports of harm to those which are substantiated or which you believe need more investigation?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. So our mandate is to resolve issues. Mm-hmm. So if there's no issue for us to resolve, somebody got up, mm-hmm. tried to go to the restroom without assistance, fell. Mm-hmm. The home did the appropriate thing, checked them out, worked up a plan possibly to prevent future falls. Mm-hmm. That's not really an issue that we would like to spend our time on. Mm-hmm. We would prefer to spend our time on issues that residents need our assistance and want our assistance.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay. And there might even be another way to look at the language for that that could sort of more specifically, I think, get to what you're trying to get at. Is there other questions for Ms. Holt while we have her?
Thank you.
All right, we also have in the room available for questions. Thank you, Ms. Holt. Available for questions, we have Davin Williams from the Department of Law is actually on the phone, I apologize. And then in the room we have Deb Etheridge, Deputy Director of Senior and Disability Services. And we have Denise Daniello, Executive Director, Alaska Commission on Aging, in case anybody has any questions for them. All right, seeing none, for today what we're going to do is we're going to hold this bill so that we have the opportunity to consider it more fully and consider any amendments that anybody might have over to our next meeting. And then we're going to move back up our original agenda and go back up to House Bill 100, which is designating June 27th as Post-Traumatic Stress Injury Awareness Day. I believe that Representative Tuck and staff will be presenting the bill. I saw him here a moment ago.
For the record, Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. He should be here momentarily. Fantastic. He's back and forth between another committee which he is sitting on at this time. But I can get going if you would like. I'm not sure if that was him yet. Okay.
Why don't you make yourself comfortable? And
okay. I will get comfortable and go ahead and start
Representative
off.
Tuck has joined us. Thank you.
Thank
I
you
understand you're in two places at once this afternoon, so thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. Thank you for hearing House Bill 100. This is Post-Traumatic Stress Injury Awareness Day, also known as PTSI. We did have legislation last year where we changed post-traumatic stress disorder to post-traumatic stress injury. PTSI can develop following any event that makes you fear for your safety, especially if the event feels unpredictable and uncontrollable. PTSI can affect people who personally experience the threatening event, those who witness the event, or those who pick up the pieces afterwards, such as emergency workers. Symptoms may include flashbacks, nightmares, and severe anxiety, as well as uncontrollable thoughts about the event. So it's estimated that about 260 million people worldwide suffer from PTSI. In the United States, about 3.5% of adults are diagnosed with PTSI annually. The impact of traumatic events on children is often far more reaching than trauma on adults, not only because the child has fewer emotional and intellectual resources to cope, but also because the child's development is adversely affected. According to one study, more than 60% of children ages 0 to 17 experienced or witnessed at least one traumatic event. Between 2000 and 2014, approximately 139,000 active service members were diagnosed with one onset of post-traumatic stress within the military health system. Of these, roughly 112,000 service members were diagnosed following a deployment of 30 days or more to an overseas contingency operation. The numbers presented reflect only those service members identified by the military health system. As such, they may underestimate the true scope of the problem, since they do not reflect those service members who choose not to seek assistance because of concerns around stigma or other barriers that may discourage them from seeking help. Referring to a post-traumatic stress injury as a disorder perpetuates the stigma, which in turn discourages people seeking proper medical treatment. Raising awareness of the conditions and eliminating the stigma may encourage people affected to seek help voluntarily and allow for timely treatment that may alleviate PTSI symptoms and even prevent suicide. The United States Senate, the United States House of Representatives, and 27 states have united by bringing national awareness to individuals who suffer with PTSI. House Bill 100 will establish June 27th as Post-Traumatic Stress Injury Awareness Day in Alaska, providing for an opportunity each year to raise awareness and conduct outreach. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, would you like to walk us through a section of the bill?
Well, that should be easy. Again, for the record, Kendra Kloster, staff to Representative Chris Tuck. Section number one, which is the only section in the bill, will establish June 27th of each year as Post-Traumatic Stress Injury Awareness Day. And we, as Representative Tuck said, we passed a resolution last legislative session that we did this as 2016, June 27th, 2016, and we worked at the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs to bring awareness on that day. And we also worked with Honor for All, a nonprofit organization who has been trying to do this nationwide to make sure that we're looking at it as an injury and not a disorder. And so I have had, our office had multiple conversations with Department of Military and Veterans Affairs again about some events that we would like to do in the future. So they were supportive, and I believe online, to talk about some of the things that we want to do to make sure we bring more awareness. And June 27th was inspired by a birthday of National Guard member Staff Sergeant Joe Beal, who suffered from PTSI and took his own life on April 26, 2007. So that was the why this day was chosen and has been picked to do as a nationwide to help bring awareness to PTSI. And I believe we also have Kent Hall on the line with Honor for All, who can talk about some of the things that they have been working on and things that they have seen nationwide and their efforts into doing this. So thank you very much for hearing this.
Fantastic. Do we have any questions for the sponsors or their staff or his staff right now? All right, seeing none, we're going to go to invited testimony, and we do have Kent Hall on the line with Honor for All. Mr. Hall, are you available?
Yes, I'm here.
All right, go ahead and introduce yourself on the for the record, and then proceed with your testimony.
Very good. My name is Kent Hall. I'm Vice President of Honor for All. I'm also a Vietnam combat veteran, and I have been personally diagnosed as having PTSD. Do you want me to continue and tell you what PTSI will do for veterans?
Please do.
Okay. I left Vietnam in 1969. Unfortunately, Vietnam never left me. Even today, I still have issues that I deal with, and I deal with group therapy with 12 other Vietnam veterans through the help of a counselor through the VA. And here in Michigan and Lansing, we have four such groups of 10 or more Vietnam veterans just in this city alone that do that. Post-traumatic stress disorder, our proud soldiers, men and women, do not want to be mentally disordered. But once we, in fact, it was an aha moment for me due to the fellows at Honor for All, Doug Price, Tom Mahaney, President and Vice President originally back in 2010, and Dr. Frank Ockberg were the founders and have been working hard to create awareness through the first National PTSD Awareness Day in 2011 in Washington, D.C. In 2014, Michigan became the first state to pass a resolution making June 27th Post-Traumatic Stress Injury Awareness Day. It sounds like something very simple, but that subtle change was kind of the thing that got me to understand why I had such problems. I was not diagnosed until 2011, in fact. So I was silent for over four decades dealing with this. In 1985, I became very close to becoming one of those statistics when I tried to commit suicide by a cop. In fact, if it wasn't for a police officer violating their own protocol and tackling me and saving me, I would not be here today. But along the way, I've had a tremendous amount of help, but it was through Honor for All when they finally helped me understand that it wasn't a weakness, it was a wound. And through that, I went from silence to becoming a public spokesman. Now, we do a lot because of the veterans, because we still have 20 to 22 veteran suicides every day, and that's just not acceptable. So anything that would help is something that we're going to fight to help that end. the Honor for All is continuing. We have nearly 30 states on board with resolutions. I think six states now doing what the great state of Alaska is doing. Your reputation for looking out for veterans has certainly reached our ears, and we appreciate Chris Tuck, and I appreciate Kendra Coster's work in allowing us to testify and on behalf of all veterans dealing with post-traumatic stress. It will make a difference. It can be very helpful, and again, we commend you. Indiana was the second state in 2015. So we just keep going, and we're trying to get all the states on board. Again, thank you for all the work all the people there in Alaska are doing. We really appreciate it.
Do we have any questions for Kent Hall? All right, I want to thank you for your testimony. I was lucky enough to hear your testimony last year in Military and Veterans Affairs as well when we were, looking at the definition and the title for post-traumatic stress injury, and it was moving, and I appreciate your passionate work on this subject. Thank you also for your service to our country, I hope that you've begun to find some of the healing that you need.
I have, and so are so many others. Thank you.
That's great. I believe we also have Verdi Bowen on the line.
Yes, this is Verdi Bowen from the Office of Veterans Affairs. Thank you, Chair and representatives, for allowing me to speak on designating June 27th as PTSI Awareness Day. One of the things about promoting this day is to help me promote the awareness of injuries that are caused through post-traumatic stress. And also, it's also going to provide us another tool to encourage our veterans to seek assistance. Many times our veterans will stand alone and not seek assistance at all. And a lot of times these injuries will go unnoticed or covered up by them. And it just provides us another tool in reducing our veteran suicide rates. In 2016, the VA Office of Statistics stated that there was 20 veterans that commit suicide per day. And this is really, this is a travesty as far as I'm concerned. We have the help that's out there. We just need to get the awareness to be more focused. The VA also states that currently we have about 30% of our returning veterans from our combat zones are experiencing some sort of post-traumatic stress. And it isn't all disorders or of that nature, but injuries are something that you can reach out and touch, and sometimes you can heal or provide them the assistance that they need to overcome many of those barriers that are causing them not to seek assistance. Since 2009, the VA has recognized the fact that large number is coming home because they've seen a 10% increase in utilization of their mental health services, and their response to the increase in services utilization is the fact that they've added 1,600 new mental health professionals throughout the nation, and that this is one of the ways I think that we in Alaska can reach out. Our office last year held an event on June 27th. It was we didn't have large numbers like we would expect, but this next year we're planning another event on the same day, and would like to try and to bring more veterans out to see the services that we have. If anything, just come out and just talk to us. Most of the people in my office, including myself, are combat veterans, and so we do have a common language that we can speak. And most of the time, people get confused with the post-traumatic stress. And I think that signifying PTSI instead of PTSD will help not put a stigmatism to this injury. If there's any questions, I'm open for them.
Do we have any questions for Director Bowen? All right. Thank you very much for your testimony, Director Bowen, and thank you as well for your service. All right. And now we have Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole on the phone. Can you put yourself
on the record? For the record, Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole, DMVA. Madam Chairman, members of the House Health and Social Services Committee, I'm Colonel Retired Bob Dole, Deputy Commissioner of DMVA. And for the reasons expressed by Mr. Hall and Mr. Bowen, we as a department support this legislation. I just want to clarify, though, that although all three of us are focused on veterans, maybe even target fixated on them, that PTSI is not limited to just vets, and there are many others who struggle with PTSI, and we in no way mean to demean the struggles that they face in going through it. I would just add briefly that a couple months ago I did a ride-along with the Patrol Division of the Anchorage Police Department, in the course of talking to the officers on that shift, they were unaware of the change in Alaska to the PCSI designation. Each and every one that I discussed it with there of the at one point felt it was a very beneficial tool they could use on the street when meeting a vet having a bad day to encourage them to go to the vet center or seek assistance who otherwise would not have, and ask that I go back and present to all the shift changes at the Anchorage Police Department. So the frontline folks on the street who have to deal with vets who are having some of their worst days basically recognize that this is another invaluable tool for assisting those vets through some of those times of challenges. I stand ready for any questions, Madam Chair.
Does anybody have any questions for Deputy Commissioner Dole? All right, hearing none, thank you for your testimony. I also want to thank you, Deputy Commissioner, for mentioning, reminding us all about the fact that post-traumatic stress injury isn't something that's suffered or, that's experienced only by veterans, and to connect the dots a little bit to some of the other work that we've done. Many survivors of adverse childhood experiences also suffer from post-traumatic stress injury, and one of my daughters that we were fortunate enough to bring into our family 10 years ago when she was about 9 years old, suffers from post-traumatic stress injury to this day. And what that means is that she feels intense stress and fear under situations that for the rest of us are perfectly normal and sometimes would even make us giggle. Those are sometimes situations that put her into fear. You cannot surprise her by jumping around a corner. She lives a life that is different from the rest of us because of this, and she's fortunate to have, remarkable supports around her and a big, loving family and great therapists. But post-traumatic stress injury is something that we all suffer from, or that we all can suffer from if put in the wrong circumstances. And so I want to thank the bill's sponsor, Representative Tuck, for bringing this forward. I think it's an important issue, and I look forward to recognizing and coming out and participating in the June 27th, ceremonies that take place this year. And with that, I guess I'll look to the will of the committee.
Madam Chair, I would move House Bill 100, version 30-LS0409/A. Move it out of committee with individual recommendations and attach zero fiscal note.
Is there any objections? All right, and with that, the bill passes from committee, and we're going to take a brief at ease to process the paperwork. It's 3:45, and we're back on the record. Now we're going to turn our attention to House Bill 186. That's Representative Tallarico's bill covering food donations. Representative Tallarico and staff, if you could come forward and put yourselves on the record and walk us through the bill, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and committee members. I'm Dave Tallarico. I am the representative for House District 6. And House Bill 186 seeks to reduce the amount of wasted food in the state while increasing the amount of food donated to food banks and other charitable organizations. Nearly 15% of Alaskans fall into the category of food insecure individuals. Many businesses are currently donating excess food. However, many desire to do so, but are not because of liability or perceived liability. Many charitable organizations don't receive sufficient food donations to feed the homeless and hungry. Without such charities, they have no way to eat. These charities and people may greatly benefit from more donated food. The bill allows hotels, restaurants, stores, and other food donors who choose to donate their excess food, unsold food, or outdated food to food banks or charitable organizations free from liability. This will open up the doors for thousands of pounds of new donated food to charities and thus help feed the nearly 15% hungry Alaskans. The bill will require that all food donors that choose to donate hot excess food to simply label the donated hot food that can be frozen and reserved. The bill also reduces the amount of food put into our landfills, and I have some previous municipal experience having to have been the general manager of a solid waste facility. the smell and attractant for animals and birds is tremendous there, and actually it probably wouldn't seem like a lot on a daily basis, but if you did that for a year and thought about the space that you consume in your solid waste facility, certainly be well worthwhile for municipalities, and particularly large municipalities, or a municipality like the one we're in, to save as much space as possible. So I would like to urge your support for the bill to help reduce the amount of wasted food and increase the amount of donated food to decrease hunger in Alaska. And Madam Chair, one of the issues that was brought up to me by several people were they're pretty sure that this is already covered under some Good Samaritan laws, mostly those that are created by the federal government. I think probably the issue that arises with several of the organizations that aren't very comfortable with doing that is the Good Samaritan law is really based on delivering some type of emergency service or care to people that are in peril at a particular current time. And whether it's actual or perceived, several of these people feel that their liability would not be covered because of the way those laws are written. So they currently have policies in place that say they would rather not do that because of the liability issue that arises. Thank you for your time, and if you'd like, I will let Mr. Verhagen introduce himself and walk you through the sections.
Please do so.
Thank you, committee. For the record, my name is Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Tallarico. So if we go to the sectional analysis, we'll go through the bill here. Section 1, it amends the statute by adding charitable organizations in statute next to food banks. So if we open up the actual bill itself on page 1, line 6, you'll see there. So already the food bank is receiving a lot of donations, and we have several of these charitable organizations online today that they're going to be testifying. So already the food bank receives a lot of food. However, charitable organizations, shelters, churches and other organizations that would be donating this excess food or going and collecting and then donating this excess food are not covered in statute yet. And so this is adding them along with food banks to where any businesses can donate to these charitable organizations as well and be free from liability. If you look on page 1, line 14, this paragraph does not apply to the label required under D2 of this section. And so that is clarifying that the labels referenced in this statute do not include the new label referenced in section 2 of this bill, which I'll talk about in just a second, dealing with the hot food. On page 2 of the bill, line 3, it adds, which is currently not in statute, it adds a date on the food indicating when the food is best eaten by or used has expired. So right now, Fred Meyer, we've talked to Fred Meyer, Walmart, some of these big chains, as well as, and again, even small businesses of any size, hotels, restaurants, but they can't sell food that's outdated. And so by adding this additional language in here, they can now donate, you know, a day-old expired bag of chips or whatever it may be. And then you'll see again line 5 of page 2, adding charitable organization in there again with the food bank. Jump down to section 3, page 2, line 19. It adds charitable organization again, same on line 21. Same on line 24. This is much of what the sectional is adding it back, adding in charitable organization. Line 27 as well. Flip the page to section 3 and line 1, 3 and 4 again is adding charitable organizations next to food bank. And then adding on page 3, line 10, again adding that that label of outdated food as far as being expired. And so section 1 is making businesses free from liability to donate to food banks and charitable organizations. And then this section 3 is referring to food banks and charitable organizations that give food to the poor and the hungry. They are also free from liability. I talked with several of them, and one in particular in Fairbanks that I talked to, the manager of the shelter said, no one's sued us yet who's eaten our food and gotten sick, but they appreciate this extra level of protection if someone were to choose to do that. So it protects the food banks and the charitable organizations from liability as well as the businesses. Jumping back to section 4 on page 3, there's definitions, section 4, line 13. So there's the definitions of what a donor includes, and we're adding to the existing language that was already in there for a donor to include a delicatessen, restaurant, hotel, store, as people who are able or organizations that are able to donate their excess food. I would mention all of this is, of course, voluntary. There's nothing in this bill that demands that a business donates their excess food, but the hope is that, and we've talked to many of these businesses, and they don't like throwing away their excess food, and many do because of liability issues, and so this frees them up to enter into an agreement with these charitable organizations that will come, and they're going to talk about that are willing to come to them and pick up this excess food that's being donated. Going down to section 5, page 3, line 26, there are several, this is a new paragraph that adds the definitions of charitable organization, food, which includes hot, unsold hot food, and a nonprofit organization. And with that, I'm looking, I skipped over something. Oh, okay. Let's go back, sorry, to page 2, section 2, which is starting on line 11. This is a new section that we've noticed when you go to delis, there's a lot of excess hot food. Hotels, say the Baranoff receptions and et cetera that we go to, there's always a lot of excess hot food, and most of it is thrown away. This section 2 here, starting on page line 11, a donor of unsold hot food to a food bank or charitable organization is immune from liability as provided in the section if, and so this was a safety thing that we've worked out talking to some of the charitable organizations and what they would want from the stores or the businesses. So at the time the food is donated, the food is apparently fit for human consumption, and the donor labels the food with a statement that reads, "This food has been previously heated, best if kept frozen until ready to eat." So that is what the charitable organizations would prefer, that this previously heated food is labeled, just so when they come pick it up and they freeze it, as soon as they thaw it and are serving it, it gets served as soon as possible, and therefore it's not continually thawed and refrozen and thawed and refrozen. But at the same time, we didn't want a specific label that companies would have to go out of their way to buy, etc. That would probably just decrease the amount of businesses wanting to donate. But this is a simple label with this wording that any business could, you know, print off of their printer saying that this food has been previously heated. And with that, we're here for any questions, and then we also have a lot of people online to testify on this.
All right. Thank you very much. Is there any questions for Representative Tallarico or Mr. Verhagen? Mr. Vice Chair?
So I don't have this question fully formulated, but I'm going to throw it out there anyway. So when I look at the category of donor, I don't see the word charitable organization. And you have the definition on line 27, a charitable organization means a non-for-profit organization. But a donor could be providing an act of charity. Is there, I think there probably is not, but I just throw it out there. Is there any need to have a tie-in or some language tying in donor to charitable organization, possibly for tax purposes, or some benefit in statutes that would make a donor who is involved in commercial activity more willing to provide the act of charity that a non-for-profit normally does, and you know, better position them for tax purposes.
Through the chair, Vice Chair Edgman. So if you look on page 1, line 5, it says a donor of food for free distribution by a food bank or charitable organization is not subject to civil or criminal liability arising. So a donor of food can give to a food bank or charitable organization, and then on page 3 it defines what a donor is. So, and then as far as them for tax purposes, I think the lawyer that drafted this, Terry Bannister, I believe she's online with us, and or you may be able to answer the question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as a former professional fundraiser, I can answer that the that donors are a donor their financial incentive to donate is well detailed in federal tax law, and that they simply need to identify the value and attributable value to the item themselves and add it to their own taxes. It's actually the responsibility of the individual in-kind donor to make that specific distinction, although nonprofits can also offer specific receipts as well. Representative Johnston?
Yes, sort of a follow-up to that. I don't see caterer in here. Am I missing it? It is in the afternoon, so I could be missing it.
No.
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, on page 3, starting on line 15, mm-hmm. a donor includes a person, farmer, retailer, delicatessen, restaurant, hotel, store.
Does not include caterer.
So, yeah, the actual word caterer is not in there. We could, again, if Terry Bannister is online, she may be able to speak to that and see if they are included. If not, we probably could add that word. No problem.
Thank you. Ms. Bannister, are you on the line?
This is Terry Bannister.
Did you hear the question?
Yes, I did hear the question. I think the definition of donor has a lot of terms that would certainly include caterer, like a person is pretty broadly defined by our statutes. And we also add in there a similar entity or similar entity, but you certainly could put caterer in there. There's no problem with that. There are a lot of IDA people who have been specifically included.
Mm-hmm. All right. Does that answer your question, Representative Johnston? Representative Tarr, did you have a question?
Just a couple comments. I was on the food donation part of it. The federal government about a year ago actually made some tax incentives specifically for food donations. So there's new provisions in the tax law, and I think Feeding America might be the place to get that information for anybody who's interested. But also, the only thing I would add is just in your presentation, I hope if you would mention that in the United States every year we throw away enough food to feed the country for half a year, just to stress how much room there is for improvement. That is my only comment. This is an issue we've worked on for a couple years, so I'm really glad to see this bill come forward.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, and through the chair, Representative Tarr, some of the people that...
You identify yourself.
Oh, sorry. For the record, Elijah Verhagen, staff to Representative Tallarico. Through the chair, Representative Tarr, yes, thank you for that comment. We will work with we've already been in contact and have some of the info from Feeding America, but we'll try to get that how much is actually thrown away, and then some of the people that are going to be talking, including the Fairbanks Community Food Bank, they're going to be talking about how many tons of food they are currently salvaging and how much they anticipate that they can continue to salvage mm-hmm. Through this if this bill were to pass.
Mm-hmm. I have a question actually as it relates to as it relates to this specific bill. I'm a huge fan of making sure that we're reducing waste to its absolute minimum, especially when trying to address the problem of hunger in our state, and I've worked on this issue for many years. So I appreciate the sponsor and your work on this bill. One of the challenges that this bill seeks to solve in terms of making sure that hot previously served foods can be donated, which actually is done quite often, but I think the idea was to reduce perceived liability about it, is that we still have food safety and handling challenges, and once food has gotten up to a certain temperature, it creates some challenges in making sure it gets cool enough quickly enough to be safe again. And have you discussed this with food safety and handling experts, and do you have any concerns about this that would help to calm my concerns?
Yeah, to the chair, Elijah Verhagen, for the record, we have talked about that, and we've worked with several of the supporters of this bill from the Fairbanks Community Food Banks and others regarding that issue. And whatever is donated to them, they already have policies set in place themselves, these charitable organizations and shelters, etc., to where they felt that labeling was appropriate. But at the same time, if there's any food that they're at all questioning mm-hmm. is not fit for consumption, they won't serve it to the people that they serve. And so they already have their own procedures, and maybe some of them can talk about that when they come online. But yeah, that is definitely something that largely is they have policies built in and they're well aware of.
Sure, and I just want to be clear. It looks like on page 3, on line 27, it section 5, line the third bullet number 3 says charitable organization means a nonprofit organization that provides food without charge to individuals who do not have money to pay for the food or who do not have homes. I also see bullet number 5, which just says, has the sort of more traditional garden variety version of nonprofit organization, which is recognized by the state or federal government as a nonprofit organization. And as sort of going back to the food safety and handling piece, I'll just point out I've worked for a lot of nonprofits that had no expertise in food safety and handling, so it's still like a kind of a little lingering niggle for me. But I know also that we have several experts on the line, and so perhaps we can get their testimony as to that. All right. Any other questions for the bill sponsor? All right. Super. Let's see. It looks like first people on the line here are with Fairbanks Community Food Bank. We have Hollis Hall and Samantha Kirstein. Are you on the line? At the Fairbanks LOO, I guess, huh?
Yes, there we are.
All right, why don't you introduce yourselves and put your testimony on the record.
I'm Hollis Hall. I reside at 2816 Chief Alexander Drive, Fairbanks 99709. And my thanks to the chair and also to Representative Tallarico for bringing forth HB 186. I have been the secretary of the board of the Fairbanks Community Food Bank since 1999. And I was born during the Great Depression and became a teenager during Second World War, and I remember ration books and ration stamps. Food waste was not an option when I grew up. But now it seems to be, as I hear some of these statistics. I volunteer one day a week, putting up boxes at the food bank. And during that day, we may put up a couple of tons or more of food that would otherwise be waste if it were not brought to the food bank. It would be discarded. But we find a use for it. There have been days, however, that we've had a shortage of some of the fresh fruits and vegetables. So I think there's room for more. Our objective is to see that no one goes hungry in the Tanana Valley, and we can best do that if people will bring and donate food that can be used to alleviate that hunger. and we thank you very much for this opportunity to testify and for this bill that's been brought forth. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is Samantha Kirstein there as well?
Yes, I am here. My name is Samantha Kirstein. I was the executive director of the Fairbanks Community Food Bank for 26 years, and now I serve as the director of community development. And I thank you for such a simple and important contribution to the work of food banks in Alaska. There's a similar federal law called the Good Samaritan Law, which you've talked about already today, and that has been the backbone of national food banking for many years and does reduce the liability for those generous commercial donors who supply food to our food bank. But there is still concern expressed by some Alaska donors, and I'm very grateful to Representative Talarico, who saw and took action to prevent the waste of food, and to Representative Kawasaki and Sponholz for joining in that effort. I have asked each year for many years for a legislative thank you for the generous commercial donors in Alaska. They do not have to give us anything. In Fairbanks, in 1982, during a recession, similar to what we're facing these days, there was a small group of people who saw both food waste and food need, and they started an organization which would collect local surplus food and give it to people who need it in Fairbanks and North Pole. Their desire was that no child would go to bed hungry in the Panama Valley. Our organization, Fairbanks Community Food Bank, is still on that mission 35 years later. Each day, we collect 2 to 5 tons of local surplus food and give it to people who need it. People woke up this morning in Fairbanks and North Pole wondering where their next meal would come from. By mid-afternoon, if they ordered a food box, they will receive 20 pounds of food per person. So if it's a family of four people, that will be 80 pounds of food. We expect that food to last those four people 9 meals, 3 breakfasts, 3 lunches, and 3 dinners. And they're allowed to order 10 food boxes each calendar year on the schedule that they need. We are an emergency supply of food, locally donated salvaged food, and we work hard to earn an Alaska DEC SAFE, S-A-F-E, certificate, which means that we work at their highest standards in the collection, storage, and distribution of that food. We served 30,000 people each year in the Tanana Valley, Interior Alaska, and the North Slope. We work with 40 rural villages of Tanana Chiefs, Arctic Slope Region, Bering Straits Region, Nana Region, Doyon Region, and have been invited to assist Juneau and the villages in that area with food boxes for elders. Each year we collect and distribute over 2 million pounds of food in food boxes, and also in an agency shopping program which supplies free food to local groups such as Rescue Mission, Stone Soup Cafe, and other local 501c3 organizations. And to answer one of the questions I heard earlier, yes, we do work also, as DEC does, to train those folks to handle food in a safe manner. We work with about 100 different generous commercial food donors and distribute the food through about 100 agencies, including American Red Cross, Salvation Army, and other groups who work on issues of food insecurity in our various locations. 9/10 of all the food we collect comes through the generous donors who would benefit from this piece of legislation. These people need to be thanked, and I sent a list of their names to Representative Kawasaki's office because he offered to write letters to the local general managers. This is a great partnership between local nonprofits and the larger commercial vendors who don't even have their corporate headquarters in Alaska, and sometimes request their local managers to cease the salvage of food because some food banks and others who would like to utilize the donated food are not reliable enough to work within the rules of the national vendors. In Fairbanks, we work very hard to adhere to all the safe rules of food handling and ask our community to be thoughtful about shopping with those places who donate so generously to us. We receive dairy, produce, meat, bread, and other bakery, and occasionally cans. I'll stop here because I know you have questions about how a food bank works, but let me emphasize that in Fairbanks, we're very traditional. We're not a political organization. We salvage local surplus food and give it to individuals in food boxes and organizations who have a federal 501c3 designation. If we receive the food free, we give it away free. No handling charge. 90% of our Keep the Doors Open support comes through individual donations such as United Way, Pickwick Give, and those who work with us as volunteers. There are about 1,800 volunteers who work with us throughout the year. There are 17 days left for this bill to get through the process. I request that you move it out of committee today. It is a bipartisan project which should be something that each of you in the legislature should be proud to accomplish. It's a very good thing to do, and we thank you for it.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today, Ms. Kirstein. Any questions for Ms. Kirstein? All right, seeing none, thank you. Next, we have Carol Durr with Food Bank of Alaska.
Hi, yeah, for the record, this is Carol Durr, Director of Public Engagement for the Food Bank of Alaska. This bill enhances and complements the provisions that are outlined in the Bill Emerson Good Samaritan Food Act, which a few of us have talked about. And this has been extremely successful in supporting retail grocers and other businesses in their efforts to donate food that would otherwise be wasted. While the Anti-Hunger Network, including the food banks in our state, already have strong partnerships and robust donation programs with most national grocery stores, who collectively donate millions of pounds of food each year. Last year, we rescued 5.7 million pounds of food. We hope that this bill gives extra assurances to other types of small business owners who might be hesitant to donate because of any perceived liability. We have 106,000 Alaskans who are facing food insecurity, so it's important that we do all we can to look for ways to reduce food waste and encourage donations. So thank you all for working on this and calling attention to this issue.
All right. Any questions for Ms. Durr? All right. Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Durr. And then we have Eddie Azelli from SL? SL. SL. All right. Matsu Food Bank.
Hi, this is Eddie Azell with the Matsu Food Bank. I'd like to read a statement if I can, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate you listening to all this testimony. This is my first time, so bear with me when I stumble through this. I'm here to encourage you to pass the HB 186 because all of us here in the nonprofit food area are seeing reductions in giving, and this could overcome one of those hurdles. The bill, HB 186, helps protect food distributors from unnecessary lawsuits concerning any of the donated food products that are still consumable by humans. The nonprofits, 501c3s, such as the Matsu Food Bank, are allowed to pick up and distribute these donations to people in our area in need. This also serves our community in several ways, as mentioned in the bill. Food is not filling our landfills. It helps families in hunger situations, which they may not have control over. The state could also save money in reducing the costs and funding allowing the distribution of these donated foods. It also, again, helps with our landfills. And this is all due to the fact of people being afraid of being sued. We struggle enough to provide for those in need, and you can help us overcome this one hurdle by passing HB 186. I urge you today to please push 186 forward to help us and others in need here in the great state of Alaska. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Azell. Does anybody have any questions? Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Through the chair. Eddie, I just want to say thank you for all your hard work in the Matsu, and I wholeheartedly support this legislation, as I know you do. So thank you.
Thank you for being there for us.
All right, and that looks like that's the scope of our invited testimony today. I want to thank the bill's sponsor. We're going to hold this one over, and we'll hear it again shortly. Thanks. All right, so now we're going to turn our attention to House Bill 159, which is addressing the opioid epidemic in Alaska. We're going to be hearing from the Department of Health and Social Services, taking public testimony, discussing amendments, and then looking to the will of the committee. So come on up. I think you guys know the drill.
Good
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jay Butler, the Chief Medical Officer in the Department of Health and Human Services. Not Human Services. I am not a Fed. Health and Social Services. House Bill 159 is another facet of the multi-pronged approach to addressing the opioid epidemic in that it aims to improve care of persons who are living with addiction and also to address some of the primary prevention possibilities as it relates to legal prescription opioids in the community by supporting more rational pain management practices throughout the state. This afternoon, we'd like to go through some amendments to the bill that we discussed a couple of weeks ago. Just very broadly, four concerns that we heard from various stakeholders that we wanted to address through amendments include the section that authorizes pharmacists to partially fill prescriptions for opioids. The amendment aligns the language more with the federal CARA Act, the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act, and it deletes the part that would have immediately voided any unfilled portion of the prescription. And as a result, that would also make the requirement of the pharmacist to notify the prescriber moot. Second, it also clarifies the roles of the prescriber and the dispenser throughout the SB 74 process last year, and certainly the intention in this bill related to the prescription drug monitoring program. It is that the prescribers check the PDMP prior to issuing prescriptions for Schedule II or Schedule III controlled substances, and the role of the pharmacist is to populate the PDMP when the dispensing is done. The third amendment addresses concerns related to the daily update of the PDMP, recognizing that even the weekly updates under SB 74 have not been implemented. So the amendment would specify that the implementation to daily updates would not occur before 2018, at least 1 year out. And finally, the fourth part of the major component of the amendment addresses the waiver of liability under the Opioid Advance Directive. In the bill that I presented to you a couple of weeks ago, it specified waiving liability for not administering an opioid when a directive was in place. This broadens the waiver of liability to include in the instance where perhaps a opioid is inadvertently administered to someone with an advance directive. These amendments are based on feedback from a number of stakeholders, but I specifically wanted to acknowledge the Pharmacy Association for very helpful guidance in developing these amendments, as well as a number of providers who have given some input as well. So at this point, I'd actually like to turn the microphone over to Assistant Attorney General Stacey Crailey, who can walk us through the chapter and verse of the amendments.
Actually, just procedurally, I think that I need to make a motion to move Amendment 1, and then we need somebody on the committee to object for the purposes of discussion before we can do that. So,
Madam Chair. Just a procedural question as well. Do we have to have a sponsor for the amendment as well?
I'm going to sponsor it, which is why I'm making the motion right now to move Amendment 1. And then Representative Sullivan Leonard objects for the purposes of discussion. All right, thanks. Now we've satisfied my inner Ted Madsen. So. All right, since he's not here today to make sure I do things right. All right, now we can roll through. Thank you.
Okay. thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Stacey Crailey, Chief Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law. And before you, you should have an amendment that has a date on it of 3/28/2017. Make sure we're all looking at the same page. It's a multi-page, eight pages of amendments or changes to the bill, and I can walk through each one of the little discrete parts of it for you, and I'm happy to answer any questions along the way. So the The first change is on page 1, line 3, where we amend the title to include the words relating to the practice of pharmacy. Many of the amendments that you'll hear me talk about through today are just clarifying and conforming amendments that were caught as we've read through the bill, so they're not terribly technical. So that's one of them. We omitted that originally, and it shouldn't have been omitted. The second amendment, look at page 2, lines 2 and 3. This refers to the provision that Dr. Butler just mentioned about broadening the language as to immunity related to the opioid directive. It adds the language that the this addresses the advanced directive language and provides that the commissioner shall adopt regulations to implement the chapter related to the opioid advanced directive. So again, just a technical language cleanup. The third change is on page 2, line 25, and this is the one that addresses a change to include the words "or for the inadvertent administration of an opioid," which provides an additional basis of immunity for a prescriber who inadvertently administers an opioid when a person has an advanced directive that's been adopted by this statute. The next two changes on page 15, line 14, and page 15, line 16 are changes that were recommended by the Cancer Association. We had used the language with the word "a cancer diagnosis," and they felt that that was too limiting, that if we took out the words a and a diagnosis in those two lines, that it would be a broader construction, because you may be suffering from pain post-diagnosis, that you would need opioid pain management after a diagnosis, and they felt that that was too limiting. So they asked that the word "diagnosis" be removed, and we agreed with that. I'm on page 2 now of the amendment. Page 16, following line 24, one of the things we noticed in the original legislation is that we had inadvertently omitted two practitioners for purposes of participation in the PDMP and the changes to the continuing medical education provisions. And this section corrects one of those omissions and talks about the inclusion of advanced practice nurses, and it makes conforming edits to change the nomenclature as was changed in legislation last year from to make sure we're talking about advanced practice nurses, registered nurses. Again, so now I'm on page 3, page 18, line 15, page 18, line 18. We are back in the issue of deleting the reference to diagnosis, so we have a broader construct for the exceptions for administering opioids. You don't have to have a diagnosis. It can be for, like, post-cancer treatment when the diagnosis has already been addressed. On page 4, it's going to amend page 19. Following line 15, we're going to insert a new section. This is, again, one of the omissions that was inadvertently made in the original bill to include optometrists to be participatory in the PDMPs as well as the CME requirements. Mm-hmm. So we've captured all of the prescribers under the occupational licensing statutes to make sure we've caught everybody. Mm-hmm. So, now I'm on page 5. So after we get through that, we have to do some technical amendments, which is the renumber of the bill accordingly. So that's mm-hmm. just instructions to the drafters. On page 23, line 9, this one was, make sure I get this one right here. We are deleting the provision in the bill as it exists now, and there's after the word "prescribe," that everything after that through paragraph B is being deleted from the bill. Page 24, line 20 through 29.
I'm sorry, we have a question as to what that deletion is for. Thank you.
This is the partial fill provision that Dr. Butler mentioned. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, should have explained that. The change so that there were in the original bill there was a if you partially filled and voided the prescription, and this omits that to clarify that provision at the request of the Board of Pharmacy. So we had originally had, if you went in and asked for a partial fill and you said, well, I only want 3 days instead of whatever, then the prescription was voided for that period under the bill, and mm-hmm. we've changed that now so that the prescription isn't voided, but you can go back and then get the prescription filled if it's determined you need additional prescription after that original few days.
And this is Jay Butler. Also, it aligns better with the new federal law under the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act.
All right, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm on page 5 again. So page 24, lines 20 through 29 were, that's what we just did. Was that right?
No.
No. Sorry. Yeah. It's confusing. There's a lot of them in here.
Not there, yeah. There's a lot of pages.
24 through 29. Hang on here. I have to make sure I'm...
It's section 29.
Section 29. Right. So we're making a change to the bill under relating to how we address when an opioid is being prescribed. So the PDMP applies to a prescription that is being issued to an inmate upon release from the Department of Corrections. So this is a clarifying amendment. Missing something there?
This is Jay Butler again. Also, it updates the language to specify that it's for Schedule 2, 3, and 4 drugs. I think the old language had included federal Schedule 1s, which are actually illegal substances. It's just a little cleanup.
Yeah, so the whole Section 29 is taken out in the amendment and redrafted in the amendment so that it clarifies those two points. On page 25, line 8, we're deleting the word daily and inserting the word weekly. So, again, this goes to the issue that arises out of the transition from current statute to the Senate Bill 74, which goes into effect in July of this year. We went from a 30-day lookup on the PDMP under Senate Bill 74, which passed last year. We went to a weekly update. This bill originally wanted to go to a daily update, but in discussion with providers, we've agreed to delay that, and there's some effective date language here. So we're going to go for a week for 1 year, and then we're going to go to a daily implementation in 2018.
Okay.
So that's this fix, which is to maintain the weekly lookup for one year.
Okay.
On page 25, following line 23, we're going to add a new section in the bill, which, again, this goes to the daily and weekly. Again, this is a drafting issue. It may seem very confusing, but I recall having similar conversations last year with Senate Bill 74 that you have to repeal it and you have to adopt it, and it has to be fully set out in the language. So it's a drafting convention. It's kind of confusing that it's in there twice, but it has to be for drafting purposes and for effective date purposes. So, I'm on page 6 of the amendment now, page 27, lines 21 through 25. This was a request that was made on behalf of pharmacists and prescribers alike. Mm-hmm. The language was a little confusing, so what we did is we amended the language so it's very clear that a pharmacist must register with the PDMP, and they then submit information on the PDMP, and that a prescriber registers and reviews the PDMP. So there was a concern by the Pharmacist Association that the way it was originally drafted, that they had to review the PDMP, which doesn't make sense in terms of how they practice, so we just clarified the language to make sure pharmacists do one thing, prescribers do another thing, and that's what this amendment does. on page 7 of the amendment. Okay, this is where it gets kind of fun and technical, so bear with me. Page 29, line 23, these will address changes to Chapter 25, Session Law 2016, which is the Senate Bill 74 language. So again, this is a technical amendment to deal with the changes as to delayed effective dates. Certain things are being repealed in July, some things are not being repealed, so this is just it's a complicated drafting issue that is hard to explain but needs to be done. Otherwise it gets very confusing. Page 29, line 27, we have changed. Hang on, I gotta get to the right spot here again. Page 29. Oh, I'm on the wrong thing. You have that right there? So this is in the current bill, it's section 39, and this addresses changing the framework for transition regulations. And again, this is uncodified law in the original bill, and what we've done on the amendment for page 29, line 27, mm-hmm. and then the assertion on page 29 to line 30 is to assure that the Department of Commerce and Economic Development has sufficient time to start preparing and drafting regulations that then will become effective upon adoption of future effective dates. So this is transitional language to allow the department to continue to start working on regulations even though certain provisions of the bill are not effective. It wasn't quite clear that that was the way it was drafted in the original bill. And again, another complicated technical drafting rule.
I'm sorry.
Uh-huh.
Question, Ms. Crayley. There is on page 29, line 31. There is already a B, which starts with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development.
So what we have done through the chair, Madam Chair. So again, we've made the change in subparagraph A, which is line 26 through 30, mm-hmm. and added the new language. And then we've renumbered B and C, subparagraph B, which is down below, and that deals with the issue of subparagraph B deals with how to adopt regulations to implement the provision of the act dealing with who should register and review and who should register and submit information to the PDMP. There's a lot of regulation authority that needs to go along with operationalizing the PDMP, and this is transitional language to allow them to do it in a timely fashion.
All right. Thank you. Perhaps it'll be more clear to me when I see the rolled up CS.
Better. A mock-up will be very helpful. You know, when you have it all in there, it'll make sense. The effective date sections, section 43 on page 7 of the bill, or the amendment, I'm sorry, section 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, and 48. These all relate to conforming edits and changes that need to be made as a result of Senate Bill 74 mm-hmm. and the rolling effective dates of how the PDMP will operate. Section 48, which is line 4 of, I'm on page 8 here, the effective date clauses, just so you understand, there's a bunch of different effective mm-hmm. date clauses. Section 48 changes the section 36 and 37 of the effective date makes the Board of Veterinary it's kind of hard to explain, but there's the board needs to be in at the effective date of the changes for the Board of Veterinarians needs to be the same as all of the other boards, so that's a conforming edit to make sure everybody's going into effect at the same time. Mm-hmm. Section 49 is an effective date of July 1, 2018, and this deals with the changes to the occupational licensing boards as to the CMEs and the obligations of the boards to implement changes for participation in the PDMP, so they all apply at the same time. Section 50 is effective dates as to Section 1 and 40 of the bill, which deal with the opioid advance directive, so they are all on the same time, and that provides an effective date of July 1, 2019. And then everything else in the bill, except as what I just talked about, all has an immediate effective date. So a lot of conforming edits and changes just to make sure everything rolls at the same time. And it'll look better when I see us.
All right. Representative Easton, you have a question?
I do. Yes, through the chair. Now, going back to page 5 of the amendment for a moment, I'm not sure I totally understand what's going on here in lines 19 and 20. As I'm reading the amendment, we set out to have a fairly comprehensive controlled substance prescription database. We spell out it's going to do Schedule 2, 3, and 4 controlled substances. Anybody's going to get caught up in that to collect that information, except a patient at a healthcare facility. And then we decide in this amendment that we're not going to collect the data from a correctional facility. And I'm wondering why that is. Why would we not want to capture that data when we are dispensing prescription opioids in a correctional facility just because it has to be at the end of a term?
through the chair, Representative Eastman, in the original bill, we need to make sure that we're only covering the appropriate controlled substance schedule. So that's one of the changes, which is when you look at the original bill, we want to make sure we're dealing with Schedule 2, 3, and 4 controlled substances as required under federal law. The previous language was provided for included additional substances that shouldn't be included. As to the correctional facility and the healthcare facility, I believe that the thinking is, and Dr. Buckler can chime in and add to this or correct me, but the idea is we want to be able to identify, and we want the Department of Corrections to access the PDMP upon discharge from a correctional facility. But for the purposes of the PDMP is to make sure that people aren't doctor shopping or being overprescribed. And when you're in a correctional facility or you're at a healthcare facility, it's a confined environment. And so there is no the ability to doctor shop or to be overprescribed or to make to the purpose of the PDMP is lost because you're in a controlled environment. And that's why when you're in the facility, we're not requiring you to look at the PDMP, but when you get out of the, when you're getting ready to be discharged, we want to make sure we understand what's happening, and that information, when you're prescribed an opioid upon release, that is provided to, that's put in the PDMP so that when you're out and you go to your next appointment or you go to the next pharmacist, they have to look it up and see, oh, you just had an opioid prescription 3 days ago, so we know what's going on. But otherwise, you're in a controlled environment, and the purpose of the PDMP doesn't exist in the same way as it does for the rest of us.
Follow up.
All right, follow up.
Also through the chair. So maybe asked a different way then. If we have a provider at a healthcare facility, a correctional facility, we would want to capture their information as far as their prescribing habits compared to their peers, though, right?
Go ahead.
Well, this is Jay Butler again. Representative Eastman, a lot of the focus is on the outpatient use. As you may be aware, in just looking back at the history of the opioid epidemic, one of the original reviews of the risk of addiction and substance misuse was based on an analysis of hospitalized patients, which showed that the risk of problem use after being administered an opioid during hospitalization was extremely low. Unfortunately, those data were really misapplied to outpatient settings. So I think it's still fair to say that in the setting of a patient who is institutionalized, the risk is relatively low. That's one of the reasons why when a patient is approaching release, they would transition to where, again, if there's going to be a drug taken with them when they leave the institution as a discharge medication, we would definitely want visibility on that.
Thank you.
Is there any other questions? Representative Johnston.
Thank you. When you had the amendment as far as advanced practice registered nurse, I got thinking about physician assistants, and I see, and maybe that is part of the title with the practice of medicine, but I'm wondering how that's addressed.
Representative Johnston, through the chair, physician's assistants are included, and they're regulated under the medical board.
Mm-hmm. So that different than the nursing board?
Yes.
Right. Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Do we have any other questions for Dr. Butler or for Assistant A.G. Crayley? All right. Seeing none, thank you very much. I believe we have a few people that have been waiting to testify. I'm going to ask Joshua Stream, who I believe is on the off-net.
Yes, can you guys hear me? Okay.
All right, go ahead and identify yourself for the record.
Brief at ease.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members.
One moment.
Ready?
We're going to take a brief at ease. A moment of protocol. I'm sorry if you can just be patient with us for one moment, Mr. Stream. We still have an objection to the amendment. Representative Sullivan Leonard, do you still hold your objection?
No, Madam Chair, I do not.
All right. Does anybody else have an objection to adopting the amendment? All right. Seeing none, we're going to go ahead and adopt the amendment. Thank you very much for the protocol update there. All right. I'm sorry about that, Mr. Stream. Go ahead and proceed again to put yourself on the record and testify. Thank you.
All right. Hi, Madam Chair and committee members. Thanks for your time. I'll put myself on record. This is Dr. Josh Stream calling from Anchorage. I'm an anesthesiologist at Providence, Alaska Medical Center. I'm fellowship trained in acute pain management, and I'm the chair of the Pain Management Council here at PAMC. And that council is an interdisciplinary group of medical providers, clinical leaders, and administrators, all dedicated to improving pain management for the benefit of our patients. I'm calling in wholehearted support of Bill 159, especially regarding opioid dispensing limits and most especially in provider education. In my experience with patients and providers in every specialty, I see inappropriate pain management every single day, and I see patients being hurt as a result. This almost always involves the overprescription of and over-reliance on opioids, which is a huge patient safety issue. And addiction and dependence is not the only issue. Opioids have many further acute side effects that result in hospital readmissions, poor pain control, and everything else that entails. And we see this mismanagement in patients both in the hospital and in the community. I've spent years committing my practice to provider education regarding safe and effective pain management because a lot of providers seem to be stuck in a different sort of practice from decades past. This is actually why we created the Pain Management Council back in 2015. Here at PAMC, over the past 2 years, we have spearheaded comprehensive efforts in provider education, which have had a dramatic impact on prescribing practices. As a result of our educational efforts, the pain management in our hospitals improved significantly just over the past year and a half or so. We're less dependent on opioids as a group of providers than ever before. This is across all specialties, surgery, internal medicine, pediatrics, emergency medicine, urology, obstetrics and gynecology, orthopedics. However, ensuring consistent and appropriate education for providers outside of our institution has been a struggle, and this bill will open the door to achieving that goal. I think it's appropriate to address the patient end of things with support and treatment for opioid addiction and recovery. But it's only a band-aid for what we see as the underlying problem, which is a lack of provider education. We need to stem the tide of inappropriate opioids flooding through our pharmacies into the patient's bodies, and the only way to do this is by mandating and overseeing provider education to ensure the best, safest outcomes for all patients in Alaska, not just those that happen to be at our hospital. So as a medical profession, we help to create the current opioid crisis, and it's our responsibility to help turn it around. And I believe that HB 159 is a step in the right direction.
Thank you for your testimony, Dr. Stream. Does anybody have any questions for Dr. Stream while we have him? And unless it wasn't, just in case it wasn't totally clear, we have officially begun public testimony. I haven't been doing as good of a job of channeling my inner Ted Madsen as I'd like. All right, so next on the line, we have Michael Carson, who is chair of the Matsu Opioid Task Force.
Yes, Madam Chairman. Thank you for this opportunity to be in full support of HB 159. My name again is Michael Carson, and I am the chair of the Matsu Opioid Task Force out in the Valley. And the question is, why is this bill so important? We know that 80% of heroin users started with opiate painkillers, and we know that 75% of those individuals got those pills from their parents, friends, or stole those pills, and many of them actually get them from their grandparents. I suggest that as a state we start looking at a program called Mind Your Meds that would be able to cut the spigot off. And I just wanted to let you know, and that many of you already know, that heroin now is being mixed with fentanyl, and that fentanyl is 50 to 100 times more powerful than morphine. The newest data that came out as of March 18th was presented and published from the University of Arkansas, the Medical Science Department, and they concluded that with the initial 10-day prescription of pain medication, that it can translate to 1 in 5 patients becoming long-term users. Dr. Martin's last statement with that conclusion was, didn't really expect that. And so we know that addiction is cunning, baffling, powerful, and most unfortunately, very deadly. 90 people die of overdoses every day nationally. So as a consumer of medicine, I need to be aware of the addiction potential of pain meds, and that I believe that that's important for all people in the medical field. I want to again tell you that the Matsu Opioid Task Force has over 100 community members, and we're in full support of HB 159 and all the new amendments that have been addressed. Thank you for your work, and thank you for everything you do.
Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Carson? All right, Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carson, I'm just wondering, through your task force and organizations like yours, you know, if we put a bill like this into place, how do you think there could be a partnership between, say, your organization, you know, in terms of, would you be able to help educate people about it, or, you know, how do we connect the dots between, you know, changes in the law and things we try to do on the policy side with the community activists like yourself who are on the ground and really seeing the problems?
Well, thank you for that question, and it just so happens that Dr. Jay Butler is going to be presenting at our next task force meeting, which is, we always meet the first Tuesday of every month, so that will be actually next Tuesday, and Dr. Jay Butler has actually presented at our task force in the past. And last night I was on the phone with a number of other task force members at KNVQ Radio in the Valley, and we had a discussion with Dr. Butler and the governor. So we're in close contact with the governor, and we're in close contact with Dr. Butler. And again, he will be presenting this information to the Valley at our next task force meeting. And as I said, we have over 100 members, and it's always a full house. So we will do whatever it takes to get this information out and to be able to provide the information for our community. And we have identified 5 top priorities, and one of those is prevention. And so what we're hoping to do is be able to get that information out into schools. We're engaging civic groups. I was today visiting a faith-based group, so we're hoping to engage that part of the community, because we know that we need to have all the stakeholders at the table to be able to find solutions to this plague. Did that answer your question?
Thank you. It did in part, and I'll be glad to hear about the results of that meeting and if any other ideas come out of that, because this is very heavy on the prescription side of things and, you know, trying to, I think, you know, sort of aimed at removing the supply. But I'm just thinking, you know, groups like yourselves, you're right there, you know the families, the people impacted, and so if any other ideas come out of that, I would love to hear back from you and or, you know, through your representative here on our committee, and just think if there's, you know, anything we're missing, and thank you for your work.
Yes, I would like to just let you know that we just launched a new website, MapsuOpiateTaskForce.com, and we actually have a resource list with all South Central providers on it, and what we are doing is that we're looking at developing a page two, which would be all the non-clinical support. That would be Feeding the Clean, that would be Fallen Up Ministries, Real About Addiction, and a good news is that Anchorage is going to have their first opioid task force meeting 4/11, and so now Anchorage is going to be able to launch theirs. We were able to reach out to Bristol Bay, Carol Wren, and Cooper and Copper River Valley has reached out to us. So we're helping those that are wanting to help their communities also. So you can visit our website, and we will try to keep you in the loop on everything that we're doing. And if you have any suggestions, there's a contact through the website, that Gmail account, and you can ask any questions that you may feel is appropriate, and we'll get back to you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And it looks like we have a couple of people in the room here. Christina Love. And Kara Nelson will be next, if you want to move your way up.
Okay. Hi, I'm Christina Love. Thank you so much for hearing me. I'm a person in long-term recovery from IV heroin use and other mind-altering substances. I am the Community Resources Coordinator for AWARE. I work with women and children that have been physically and sexually harmed. I'm the Disability Abuse Response Team Coordinator for Juno, and I was on the Opioid Task Force. I'm here in wholehearted, full support of House Bill 159. I strongly agree with the non-opioid directive, rational pain management practices, and the continuing care education for prescribers. And I was just sitting back there listening and thinking about, you know, my own experience and the people that I work with, and thinking about all the different prescribers that we have here in Alaska, and the power of right now someone is being overprescribed, right this very moment. Right now someone is not receiving the education from a prescriber that they desperately need. My file at ANMC, at Chief Andrew Isaac, at Bartlett Regional Hospital, at Providence Medical Center, at Ethel One Medical Center, every single file that I have says that I am allergic to opioids, and if I'm given opioids, then I break out in handcuffs. No, it says that I will die. And I've painted a very clear picture for every doctor and nurse's physician and nurse that I've come into contact with of what my life looked like prior to coming into recovery. That when I was using, that when I went through detox, I couldn't even lift my arms because I have my track marks. That I was on multiple drugs and I was living on the street. And I call it economic survival, that my life had absolutely no meaning at all. You know, that I tried to kill myself several times and overdosed several times. That is where I left my addiction. And coming into recovery, even with that picture, when I had my daughter in 2003, I had to over and over and over tell them that I could not have opioids. When I sprained my ankle, they tried to give me a shot of Dilaudid, and I had to tell them over and over and over. When I had my wisdom teeth pulled, I had to tell them over and over and over that I may be in discomfort, I may be in pain, but I will not die. You know, and so they would tell me something like, well, I'm going to leave it at the pharmacy for you anyway in case you want it. And I had to explain to them again, I am strong enough today to say no, but had I, maybe tomorrow looks totally different. Let's say, I mean, that this is a lifelong illness for me, and it does not always mean that I will be as strong as I am today. And if I were to relapse, that is exactly what my life would look like. And I've seen it 100 times with people that I work with and with loved ones. There's somebody very, very close to me that had 3 years in recovery
that went in for the same dental procedure that I had, and they have not made it back. I mean, and that's the reality. That is this, the importance of this bill is between life and death. We lose so many people, and my story is like so many other people that it started with prescription. I was prescribed oxycodone for a knee surgery, a very, very simple, and you know, and it led to a place of unspeakable horrors. You know, and I never want to be back there again. So I really want to have that right and have it in my file, so I don't have to have that continued education. So I don't have to have that conversation over and over. And as for our relationship with providers, there are a lot of really wonderful providers. You know, and I've spent the last 4 years in recovery educating myself about addiction and recovery, and I still have so much to learn. I couldn't even imagine. Giving a prescriber or a doctor or a nurse all the education they would need in just 2 hours. And so I just thank you so much for your consideration on this very important matter, for the opportunity to testify, and for this very important bill. Thank you.
Ms. Love, I believe that Representative Sullivan Leonard has a question.
If you don't mind.
No, I don't mind.
Through the chair. Thank you for your testimony and for all your hard work to be where you are today. I guess my question, just from listening to your testimony, is, you know, our healthcare providers seem to be so focused on only looking at opioids for pain relief. Were you ever given anything else or suggested use for any other type of relief from pain besides that?
No. We had thought about making like a safety plan. So what ended up happening when my daughter was born, and there was a lot of complications, that I actually had to have someone come and stay with me, make sure that I was taking the medication as needed, and then dump out the rest. And that's only because I had the support. They couldn't figure out any other. There's a lot more research around alternative options, but I didn't know about those. And at that point, I had been in recovery for a year. So I know a lot more now, and that would have been a wonderful option.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Ms. Nelson?
Well, thank you for this opportunity to testify, and this is a subject that's very dear to my heart. I'm also a person in long-term recovery. And that means I haven't taken a drink or a drug since June 1st, 2011. It was also the day that I was released from Lemon Creek Correctional Center. And with that, I'm also the director of Haven House Juno, which is a faith-based, peer-led recovery residence for women coming home after incarceration. I work with Christina a lot. We work with a lot of women in our community, and men as well, and family members. And I just want to bring up a few points concerning this bill. I'm in full support of HB 159, and particularly concerning the voluntary non-opioid directive. I'm just going to give you three examples because I could give you hundreds. But my daughter, 17 years old, and this is just one time where I was with her in the doctor's office, and she has had her own issues and her own journey, and especially having a mother who's in long-term recovery, you know, I'm very educated on the matter. And so, you know, when I'm going into a doctor's office and I am arguing with them, trying to be as calm as possible, you're dealing with a teenager and medical, when a doctor says something, it's golden. I mean, it's very difficult to go against something a doctor says. And, you know, that was just a very uncomfortable situation that could have been avoided as a parent, but also in her own recovery, which she is battling right now. And then I think about the women that come into our home who are in long-term recovery. One that comes to mind, I talked to her earlier today. She wanted to come testify but wasn't able to. And she went to Nugent's Rance for 9 months. Super strong in her recovery. Came, lived at Haven House. She had 17 months clean and sober and went to the dental office for to get her wisdom teeth out. Now, we have rules surrounding that in our home, and we've since changed those rules based upon the Surgeon General's report and really being able to speak with other doctors. And because of being in recovery, we understand that the concern and the it's just very harmful. So she ended up relapsing, and she came to me the next day. It was literally 2 days after taking the opioids. She came in. She had already been shooting heroin. She, thank goodness, came to me within 24 hours and said, "Kara, I don't want to live like this anymore." So we called her PO. You know, we went through the process, and we were able to get her back on track. She today now has 7 months clean and sober again. But she said, when I was in recovery and I told my doctors, you know, that I cannot take opioids, as Christina just testified, it's life and death for us. You know, at that point, she had a choice to make when the doctor said, "I'm going to give you these." And as someone in recovery, you know, we know early on that we can't have those decisions a lot of times. And so, you know, that could have been avoided in that moment. I am known in the community as someone in recovery. You know, and my doctors know that. And I've been offered prescription medications that are obviously not in, you know, support of my recovery. And I have to tell them time and time and time again. And so, you know, I think the education piece goes along with that. I think if our medical community, 2 hours within 2 years of a renewal, that's, I mean, I'm not going to go into that, but yes, I'm in support of that, although I just think it's super minimal compared to what we're dealing with here. And like Christina was also saying, we do have some incredible providers in our community. And even those who have come at it from a good place, you know, and are educated, there's things changing so rapidly in our recovery communities and our addiction and just the information that's out there that, I mean, I have to keep up every single day. So I can't imagine going to school to be a doctor and then only having to come back, you know, years after to be updated on what the best practices are for that. Just one quick statistic. We have 249 million prescriptions that were prescribed in 2013. That's every single family, every single adult in the United States of America with a bottle of prescribed opioids. That's crazy. And this is one tool that we can use to bring health and wellness to our people. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Nelson. And to both you and Ms. Love, thank you very much for putting yourselves out here to talk about your recovery and use your personal experiences as you know, information to shine light on a subject that is complicated, challenging, often intractable for many, and yet completely preventable. And I appreciate your sharing your wisdom and your perspectives with the rest of us. It's very, very helpful. With that, I'm going to leave public testimony open on this. We're going to hear this bill again next week. I want to make sure, given that we've had this very complicated amendment, that everybody has an opportunity to read through the CS in full before, and as well as to consider any possible amendments before we vote on it in final. And I want to also make sure that people remember not to leave until you've signed the paperwork. It is 5:05, and this hearing of House Health and Social Services Committee is now adjourned.